It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what is the role of the U.S. Congress in conducting foreign policy? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Under the U.S. Constitution, the administration of foreign policy is a shared responsibility between the President and Congress. The President often initiates and directs foreign policy, but those policies are subject to review by Congress, to oversight, and certainly to funding by members of Congress. In particular, the Senate has the right to agree, that is, to provide consent to treaties and trade agreements. But two recent acts by the Republican-controlled Congress have led some to wonder whether or not the legislative branch, at least its Republican members, may have crossed the line. In February, the leader of the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, Speaker John Boehner, invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak to Congress about what Tel Aviv views as a bad deal that is evolving in the Iranian nuclear talks. Mr. Boehner extended the invitation without alerting or conferring with the White House, bypassing normal diplomatic protocol. Then, the fractious debate over a possible nuclear deal with Iran escalated when 47 Republican senators warned Iran about making an agreement with President Obama. In a rare congressional intervention into diplomatic negotiations, the Republicans signed an open letter addressed to the leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran, declaring any agreement without legislative approval could be reversed by the next president, quote, with the stroke of a pen. The letter, which the White House says undercut foreign policy, appeared aimed at unraveling a framework agreement, even as negotiators grew close to reaching it. Well, even though the conduct of foreign policy is usually the prerogative of the executive branch, the U.S. Congress does have an important oversight and budgetary role. So did the Republicans, who are now in charge of the legislative branch, potentially cross the line? Well, we'll find out by discussing the issue with our two distinguished analysts. P.J. Crowley is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs under the Obama administration. He is currently a fellow at the George Washington University's Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communications. And Stephen Groves, he's Senior Research Fellow at the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a conservative think tank based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us on.
Always a pleasure.
Delighted to have you both back. First to you, P.J. Crowley, let's take a look at the invitation by Republican Speaker John Boehner to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak to the Congress about what Tel Aviv viewed as a so-called bad deal that is evolving. Do you think Speaker Boehner violated diplomatic protocol by bypassing the White House, or was this perfectly a normal thing to do?
It wasn't a normal thing to do. It did bypass protocol, but that is the nature of the tensions, much of them healthy, between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It was a compelling speech by Prime Minister Netanyahu. He obviously made a compelling argument that he prefers the status quo in terms of sanctions and international pressure as opposed to an inspection regime. But at the end of the day, I think that Netanyahu will have to live with whatever the Obama administration is able to achieve, and ultimately the Iranian negotiation will succeed or fail based on its own complexity more than on external politics.
The fact that Speaker Boehner invited Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu without first alerting or confirming with the White House, how unusual is that?
Well, it is unusual. I think there was a process failure. But obviously, support for Israel is bipartisan in the United States. You know, the speech occurred in the backdrop of a very tense relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama. But I don't think it necessarily had any lasting impact.
Turning to you, Stephen Groves, again, just to comment on this one example of what many say is a breach of protocol on the part of the Republican-led House of Representatives by inviting Prime Minister Netanyahu, not the fact that the Speaker does not have the right to do that, but the way in which he did it, by bypassing the White House. Many criticize this as being very political and also turning what is normally a bipartisan relationship with Israel into much more of a partisan matter.
I think we could all agree that the tensions between the White House and Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel didn't start with the Boehner's invitation to Netanyahu. This is something that's kind of been brewing slowly over the last couple of years, where more and more tension has shown between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu. I mean, I agree that in a perfect world, Speaker Boehner probably should have gone to the White House and said, hey, we're considering doing this. If I had to guess, he figured probably what would have happened then, which is the White House would have said, we think that's a terrible idea. He's got elections coming up, and we're in these negotiations with Iran. We don't think that you should do this. But apparently the speaker had decided that this was something he was going to do and maybe decided it was futile to go through the normal protocol and ask the White House about it first. So in a perfect world, protocol would have been followed, but we're living in a very imperfect world right now.
Turning back to you, P.J. Crowley, I want to step back before we go into the letter signed by 47 Republican senators to the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you see the role of Congress in foreign policy over history?
Well, the role of Congress is oversight of the executive, which is responsible for conducting foreign policy, and that's a very important role to play. I think there's a myth within the United States that politics stops at the water's edge. Politics has never stopped at the water's edge. As Steve was saying, the politics of foreign policy has become, you know, more acute in recent years. I was amused by the Prime Minister's opening in his speech. He said, I'm shocked that people see politics in what is happening here. You know, it's like that line out of the movie Casablanca. I'm shocked, shocked, there's, you know, our gambling going on. Of course, this was all about politics, only politics in Israel, you know, politics in the United States. And that is the context under which we're dealing with, you know, wrestling with all of these issues, is what to do about the Islamic State, what to do about Iran, and the nature of the relationship between the United States and Israel. I think there's a small irony in that just as there's tension in the leadership relationship, the reality is that in terms of overall governmental relations between the United States and Israel, they've never been better. You know, there's very strong and deep and broad level of cooperation between the United States and Israel. So the strategic context is very favorable, even though the political context, there is great tension.
Turning to you, Stephen Groves, for this open question about how you view the role of Congress in U.S. foreign policy, and even though there's always been some politics, do you think it has become more and more politicized and perhaps in an adverse way?
Well, I think that these really continue to be the exceptions to the rule. This letter to Iranian leadership, this invite to Netanyahu, the conduct of foreign affairs happens day in and day out, 365 days a year, with the executive branch being in the driver's seat 99.5% of the time. It's the fact that these incidents do spike up that they're newsworthy at all. It's just since one came after another and both are controversial, both are on very sensitive issues like Israel-Palestine and Iran nuclear deal, that it's become particularly newsworthy, which is great because that's why PJ and I get to come here today and talk to you about it. But in the main, we shouldn't lose sight of the larger picture about the day-to-day operation of U.S. foreign policy in 190-plus countries around the world. But these are interesting aberrations and good to talk about, if only for the reason to point out that they are exceptions to the rule.
Back to you, PJ Crowley, picking up on that comment about being exceptions to the rule. Nonetheless, they have occurred, and so let's take a look at the ramifications of the letter signed by 47 Republican senators. It's true that 7 did not sign on, which is significant. It just appears that notwithstanding they have a role in certainly these nuclear negotiations insofar as the lifting of sanctions and certifying that the deal is a good one. Again, many critics say it's just the way it was done. Was this a rare congressional intervention into diplomatic negotiations, a congressional letter directly to a foreign head of state? Normally, these types of relations are dealt with between heads of state.
Well, I think the letter was addressed to Iranian leadership, but it was really directed at the President of the United States. And I do think that it is a reflection of bipartisan skepticism that does exist and political opposition that quite honestly exists in Washington and also exists in Tehran. The backdrop of this negotiation is more than three decades of tension between the United States and Iran, and there are those here in the United States that want the negotiation to fail. There are those in Tehran that want the negotiation to fail because they just don't know what happens on the other side of the negotiation. I think that, you know, were Congress to pass sanctions while the negotiations are still going on, which potentially does tilt and reshape the ongoing negotiation, I think that would be a very troubling step. But the fact that you've got some political posturing in the United States about, you know, what's happening, I don't know that that's stepping over a line. I do think that it does step over the capability of the Senate. Today, the reality in Washington is you can't get 67 senators to agree on the color of the sky, you know, much less having 67 senators that would agree that an Iranian deal is a bad deal and not the national interest. I ultimately do not think that either a Senate nor a future president, because of the costs involved, will be able to do what the Republican senators outlined.
Turning to you, Steve Groves, about this letter and to what extent it represents a breach of protocol again. We said that normally heads of state deal with heads of state. And also, perhaps, was it an unwise way? I mean, one is not saying that these Republican senators don't have valid concerns, and many Democrats also, about the deal that's being negotiated. But, for example, what message do you think this sends to our European allies, that perhaps the United States can't be trusted, that, okay, the president negotiates something, but in 2 or 3 years when he's out of office, the Congress, you know, will exercise their prerogative of somehow reneging on this? Your comment on this letter and the message it sends not only to our adversaries but also our allies.
Well, I think those are going to be two very different messages. I mean, the message that it sends to the adversary is exactly what the four paragraphs of the letter said, which is you very well may be negotiating something that you think will be binding on our country and binding on future presidential administrations, but we're here to tell you the difference between a treaty and an executive agreement, and that you are negotiating an executive agreement which could be overruled by a future president. I think so. The message that they were sending to the Iranian leadership is make sure you know what you're negotiating, and we know what you're negotiating too. And so we're keeping a very close eye on what agreement's going to come out of this negotiation. I think it gets much more complicated, like you're intimating. What message is it sending to our allies, which is further negotiated by the widely understood belief that as soon as anything is agreed to with Iran in principle, that the Europeans, our allies, are going to drop their sanctions as quickly as you can say go. They don't want the sanctions in place anymore. They're more than happy to get into a great deal of business with Iran. And so they're probably not happy about Senator Cotton's letter, because they'll see it for what it is, which is a complicating factor. It's throwing a wrench in the works to what their ultimate goal is, which is to drop their sanctions against Iran. And the reason why we don't want that to happen is because then the U.S., I think, would be isolated as being the only country with strong sanctions against Iran. So I think you're sending two different messages to two different audiences with that letter.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are P.J. Crowley, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, currently fellow at George Washington University's Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communications, and Stephen Groves, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. And I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the politics and substance of the role of the U.S. Congress in conducting foreign policy. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook, or you can send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to a valued listener from Niger, Abdul Rahim. He listens to us from his residence in the Netherlands. Back to you, P.J. Crowley. On the letter, former Representative Barney Frank, the Democrat of Massachusetts, a liberal icon in his day, he said that basically both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who came to the Congress to speak about the threat from Iran, and these 47 Senate Republicans, quote, really just want to go to war with Iran. And he said that the notion that we don't like this deal, we want a better deal, is just really not plausible. And he says that to say that is on the part of the Republicans that the president isn't really in control, that we are, that we would, with a stroke of a pen, annul the agreement, is really hypocritical. And he goes on to say that under Ronald Reagan, a Republican president, and both President Bush's, that the Republicans emphasize the importance of the executive office. So it betrays anything that people like the Bushes or other Republicans, John McCain in particular, the senator from Arizona, have ever said about how to conduct foreign policy.
Well, I do think at one level it is a troubling message primarily to our allies that something that would be negotiated not just by the United States, but by all of the P5 within the UN Security Council is up to the the whims of a future president or a future Congress. I think that is a troubling message and one that we need to be clear that if the United States negotiates in good faith, its word means something. But I do think that this probably, thankfully, will exceed the capability of a future Congress or a future president for two reasons. One, I just don't think that we have an environment today where 67 senators can agree on anything. And secondly, a future president has to be very wary about the international cost of going back on this level of an agreement. First of all, if the P5 plus one reaches agreement, and that still remains a very significant if.
Absolutely.
Then it will be codified in a UN Security Council resolution. And if the United States says we're not going to abide by this resolution, even there, I don't know that, the lack of U.S. cooperation, particularly in providing intelligence to be able to have a verifiable, intensive inspection regime may diminish the capability of the IAEA, but may or may not in itself, stop the inspections from going on. And the last thing that we want, should we negotiate an intensive inspection regime, is for that inspection regime to be ineffective.
Turning to you, Stephen Groves, I think what former Congressman Barney Frank is trying to get at is what he calls the hypocrisy of the Republican senators, and also to demonstrate that what they're doing is more to snub or to undermine President Obama, whom they do not like or perhaps do not even trust. And what he's saying is, under Ronald Reagan, under several other Republican administrations, that obviously they both respect and give a great deal of credit to the executive office for negotiating and conducting foreign policy, but they make an exception, it appears, in this case, because of Democratic President Obama. Do you see the politics overriding or, in a sense, offsetting any legitimate concerns that these Republican senators have?
Well, to pick up on PJ's use of Casablanca, shocked I am that hypocrisy is breaking out in Washington. the letter, and we can debate whether it was prudent to do so or whether it was even legal to do so, but what we can't debate is that parties are opportunist and hypocritical when the other party's in control of the White House. There's a whole string of incidents going back to, Senator Kerry and Senator Harkin going to Nicaragua in 1985 to negotiate with the communist dictator, and Nancy Pelosi going to Syria in 2007, and congressional Democrats going to Iraq in 2002. And each time one of these things dusts up, and again, these are more kind of exceptions to the general rule that I'm talking about, then the other party gets its hackles up, and the other party is the one that's in the White House and starts throwing around accusations of Logan Act and accusations of being traitorous and un-American. So that's just D.C. politics. That's just standard hypocrisy all around. Both parties are guilty of it. Both parties are guilty of sending people into, delicate negotiating sessions and trying to mess up the works for the opposite party who's negotiating something. This is just the latest example. So, I take Barney Frank's comments with a grain of salt.
All right. Well, we do have a listener who more or less echoed them, a listener from Kenya, Ray Ondoro. He's worried that the Republican senators that signed the letter, he's wondering if they considered the cause and effect of their letter on partners, as we discussed, and their thought processes perhaps were clouded by their, what he calls, Obamaphobia. He also says that he's surprised that some presidential candidates, Republican presidential candidates, signed the letter. I believe he may be referring to Senator Marco Rubio from Florida, saying that, is that the way they would conduct foreign policy should they occupy the White House? And he's worried that this letter might come back to haunt the Republicans one day.
Well, I mean, the politicization of foreign policy didn't begin with this letter. It won't end with this letter. If you want to go back to the debate in the lead up to the Iraq War and then the conduct of the Iraq War and leading up to the detention and trial of detainees and the interrogation of detainees, I mean, the idea that political parties don't politicize sensitive foreign policy issues is absolute nonsense. This hasn't coarsened anything. Of course, if Marco Rubio was the next president, this isn't how he would conduct foreign policy, because he'd be the executive where foreign policy properly sits. I'm sure that if there is a Republican president elected in 2016 and he engages in foreign policy initiatives that Democrat senators are unhappy with, you'll hear from them. Maybe they'll do their own letter. But the idea that that these recent events are, you know, a new thing to come to Beltway politics, I just don't see it that way. We wish it wouldn't happen. I'm a firm believer in the executive branch and their authority to be the sole voice on foreign policy issues. And so these incidents, whether it's John Kerry going to Nicaragua or Tom Cotton putting together a letter, are aberrations and maybe even unfortunate ones. But they are things that members of Congress are wont to do when the opposing party is in the White House.
Well, back to you, P.J. Crowley. I know you said that there's not much in the politics stops at the water's edge, that is starting to really erode. But do you see a trend toward too much politicization of foreign policy as a result of this unilateral invitation to Prime Minister Netanyahu to speak to Congress and also this letter now?
I agree with Steve that that's not a bright line between the politics that always exists and where you go, you know, beyond an accepted, you know, boundary. Just to add to, if you even take it back into the Cold War, there were lots of politics during the Cold War, the so-called missile gap that, you know, became part of a campaign and in reality did not exist in the late 1950s. I think if there is a difference, we had a broad Cold War consensus about what needed to be done, you know, to counteract the global impact of the Soviet Union. And within that framework, of course, there were very significant politics. I think maybe a reflection of the time, there is a substantive disagreement over not so much the U.S. role in the world, but how you conduct your international affairs. There is a difference between a strategy of isolation, you know, and a strategy of engagement. It's the same objective. You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think, cited the appropriate objective. What we're all trying to see is to get Iran to be a normal country. There's a disagreement substantively that manifests itself in politics over what is the, you know, the best course of action. To use an analogy, the president recently made a very significant change in the U.S. policy towards Cuba. And part of his rationale was, you know, after 50 years, the policy didn't work. Let's change, you know, our approach. I happen to be intrigued by that change in policy because it, to me, it does put significant pressure on the Castro regime. You know, they're going to have to respond to the aspirations of their own people. And in such a brittle, you know, regime that they have, they'll probably be unable to do that. And likewise, I think what the president is trying to signal, because ultimately one aspect of the U.S. relationship with Iran is whether we can get to this nuclear agreement. And then the second aspect is, okay, what happens after that? And who knows what happens after that, either from an American standpoint or from an Iranian standpoint. But I think what the president's saying is, you know, after 35 years of isolation, you know, let's try to engage Iran and see where that goes. And that's a very interesting question in the context of Washington policy and politics. And it's a very interesting question in the aspect of Tehran policy and politics. But one other aspect, and I think Steve has a point about, you know, what happens if there's an agreement and what the United States does and what other countries do. But from a U.S. standpoint, it's important to recognize that even with an agreement that eases the pressure in one aspect in return for an intensive negotiation or an intensive set of inspections that would be able to document that a potential Iranian breakout towards a nuclear weapon, the United States is going to keep enormous pressure on Iran because of its, you know, being the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world. So sanctions from a U.S. standpoint are certainly not going away.
All right, and I'm going to give the last word to you, Steve Groves.
I would just follow on your main concerns about the politicization of foreign policy here, and I think we can all agree that in general it's not a good thing. Although it's a fiction, as PJ says, that politics ends at the water's edge, it would be nice if it did. And there was a time that it did more than others, like PJ mentioned, during the Cold War. What we can't kind of ignore here is the fact that this was Netanyahu's third speech to a joint session of Congress. Why was this one special? Why was this one causing so much of a kerfuffle? And I think one of the reasons is that President Obama does not want Netanyahu to be the next prime minister of Israel. I think that he thinks that he would be better with someone else in that office, and didn't want to do anything to help Netanyahu get reelected, which he did in big time. Even though they were everyone was trying to put him down in the polls, he got elected and got elected strongly. So, why was this third time such a problem for the White House? It was because they didn't want him to be prime minister anymore, and that's why. Obama had a problem with it. The president had a problem. That's why Democrats in Congress boycotted the speech, making it even more politicized. And so we can't take that particular context of Israeli politics out of the equation.
All right. Well, we'll certainly talk about the role of Congress in foreign policy in future programs. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, P.J. Crowley. He's former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. Now he's a fellow at George Washington University. And Stephen Groves, Senior Fellow at the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for your great insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.